Hi, listeners. This is Molt, a series of conversations about the ways that death and dying touch our lives. I'm Ashlyn, and I hope what you hear sparks new ideas about death in today's world. I'm so grateful to be talking to Marika today. This is special and really a perfect example of what I hope this Molt project would achieve. It's about creating space for really meaningful conversations that maybe otherwise wouldn't happen. Even within my own family, this project has prompted difficult, emotional, but ultimately what I think are healing conversations. Last year, my friend Marika reached out after I made the first podcast with Luke about the loss of his parents. Marika and I used to work together, and we'd often get lost in meaning of life conversations while standing in the office kitchen. I knew Marika had lost her dad. She told me March 2021 would mark 20 years since his passing, and that she's now lived more life without her dad than with him. I wanted to hear more from Marika about what loss feels like over two decades, from childhood to adulthood. And she felt that this conversation would be a good way to commemorate the memory of her dad 20 years later.
Hi. Yes, my name is Marika. I am really looking forward to this conversation. It's been 20 years since my father passed away. This month, I thought that this was like a really great way to memorialize him after all this time.
And I saw what you wrote about your dad on Facebook and the pictures you shared a few weeks ago. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about your dad and some of the things or people who made him who he was.
Yeah, no, he was, my dad was, he was a lot of like complicated mixes in certain ways, but he was unfailingly kind to, you know, a lot of random kind of people that he would meet. And to, you know, if we were, you know, going out to dinner, he was always like the most, I don't know, he didn't have a lot of ego. Like, he always just was like talking to the waiters, was like really gracious and would thank them. And or if we were like on an airplane, he was always really kind to the flight attendants. And he was an economist by training. So he was a professor at the University of California, San Diego. And it was kind of like a family business for him, I guess, because my grandfather was also a professor of economics. So there was he was a very, obviously like a very erudite and educated man, but at the same time was like really, really intelligent, really smart in certain ways. In other ways, like, he was completely oblivious. And he famously once asked my mom during a dinner party where the ice was because he couldn't find it, which of course my mom replied with like, just like, oh, it's in the freezer, honey. And dad went, oh, okay, right, yeah. And he got the ice, which was kind of par for the course for my dad. He was really practical in certain ways, really not very street savvy in other ways.
Well, one of the things that we've talked a bit about and that I'm really excited to talk to you about today is your experience of losing your dad over time and through different stages of your life. You were 16 when you lost your dad. So I'm wondering if, to start, can you talk about what it was like for you and your family around that time?
Yeah, gosh. When I lost my dad to pancreatic cancer, which if you've heard anything about that disease, it often creeps up on the family, where it turns out that that person has been suffering for years with it. And we just had no idea. We thought that it was something else, like it was depression, or like his doctors couldn't figure it out. They thought it was stress and depression. And then it turns out, like 2 weeks before he died, he finally got a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. So there was like many years leading up to that where we just didn't realize what was going on, where we just thought it was some sort of, you know, mental you know, thing that was going on where he just needed to have like antidepressants or, you know, like medicate in a certain way. And it just really wasn't working. And so that really, I think my first memory where I thought something was different than how my dad used to be was probably when I was 6 years old. So like 10 years before that, I just kind of noticed something shifting in him. He used to be like always like game to play, or like I would sit on his lap and he would, you know, we'd play like what we called a horseyback ride, where I would sit on his knee and he would just like bounce me, you know, on his knee, which is pretty like typical. I don't know, like you see that in the movies, but that was something that like, he was a pretty big guy. So that was always like our game when he would come home from work, and he would always be game to do it usually. And all of a sudden he kind of stopped. Could be because I got bigger and maybe I was too heavy to do horsey ride anymore. But I do feel like something just shifted at that time. Initially, it was mostly like those kind of slightly personality changes. His perspectives just, he stopped wanting to kind of go out quite as much, but it was like a slow process. And then he also started drinking more, which in hindsight, that was probably, you know, self-medicating, where he was just trying to figure out a way to kind of deal what was going on inside. And he wasn't getting a lot of help from the outside world on it. And I mean, it's hard. It is really hard to like, obviously I'm not a doctor, and I can't say with any certainty why things developed the way they did, but it was definitely like, when you look at what the kind of like symptoms are of pancreatic cancer, we were like, yeah, that's in a nutshell, like kind of what happened to him, where he went from being kind of like a rational optimist to just being, over time, over a course of like 10 years, he just slowly kind of got enervated by life, I think. And then by the time I was, you know, 14 and 15, you know, he was really struggling, I think. And like, he was able to keep going to work, but it was really tough for him. He used to get like really fantastic reviews from, you know, his students about like how much they enjoyed being in his class and how they enjoyed his lectures. And all of a sudden it got really hard for him to prepare for classes, and it got really hard for him to lecture. And the doctors were just saying like, oh, you just need a break, you know. And this is like the last kind of year of his life. They said that he just needed a mental break, that's what was going on, that they had done all these scans and they didn't see anything. So it must be psychological, must be mental. He just needed a break. So he took a sabbatical starting in the year 2000. But at that point, it progressed so much. And then he had gained all this weight, also was the other thing that happened during this time. And when that happened, that's also a kind of clear sign, it turns out, of pancreatic cancer. But again, like, we didn't know that. That was just, we just thought, well, he's always had a kind of like battle of the bulge, you know, as he called it. So he ballooned to like 300 pounds, which was definitely more than what he used to weigh. And he kind of got this moon face about him because of that. You know, he just looked kind of swollen. But the doctors kept on saying and insisting that it was psychological, that this was just, you know, nothing else was wrong. And then kind of like in the fall of 2000, he started all of a sudden dropping weight really quickly, and he started throwing up when he tried to eat anything. And that's when we could finally point to something, and like in late 2000, and start saying like, this is clearly not mental. And then they started doing tests. They thought it was the liver. They thought he had some sort of liver disease. And there was this really confident doctor that was like, I'm gonna like help your father. He just needs a new liver. And we all like were about to get tested to see who could be a liver donor. And even though my parents were both like, no, like, you guys are kids, you're not going to donate your livers. And my mom was going to try to donate her liver. And then, you know, we were going through all of that. This is like early 2001. And then come February 2001, around his birthday, that's when we finally get the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, but nobody wants to tell us. My dad didn't even, they ended up being told by like a student doctor, an intern doctor, who didn't realize that he didn't know, because nobody wanted to tell him. So the doctor just starts saying, yeah, well, we don't know about the prognosis for these things. And this just starts talking the prognosis. And my dad said, so it's true, I have cancer. And he said, you mean you don't know? Hmm. And that was just, nobody wanted to have that conversation. So, and then of course the prognosis for pancreatic cancer, for most pancreatic cancers, at least, is like just bad. Like there's just nothing you can do, especially usually when they find it, it's way too late. Mm-hmm. And it was way too late at that point. And they had done a scan of his body, I think I can't remember if it's just an x-ray or if it was an MRI, but they'd done a scan in the fall and everything checked out. They didn't see anything. And then when they did a second scan by January or February, whenever that was, his body was just riddled with tumors everywhere, and it had spread everywhere. And there was like nothing that could be done. So it was a really quick process at that point. And we had to make a lot of adjustments. At least I always think about like that in some ways we were fortunate, because we had time. Even though it was hard when we knew that he was going to die, we at least had that 2 weeks to prepare ourselves. And a lot of people never get that. You know, they just, if it's like a car accident or something like that, they just, there's no time to prepare. So, you know, we were grateful for that, but yeah, it was definitely hard. And so like every year around February to March, when he passed away, March 2nd, I always like think of that tumultuous time when our lives were just kind of falling apart around us. We were trying to figure out what to do. And Dad was also trying to do the best thing, while at the same time he was actively, you know, going away and kind of slipping away from us.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing that, Marika. And honestly, I, you know, in preparing for this interview, I think in my mind, when you hear about cancer diagnoses, you kind of imagine a long period of time to kind of wrap your mind around that. And knowing that this was a decade-long journey for your family, and you know, the experience with the medical establishment too, I mean, there's so much there. And I'm sure looking back on all of those different moments and what you learned at what time is also really hard. And that's, you know, something I wanted to speak to you before. I knew that you were just working with a 2 week period, but was your family able to find some moments of peace in that knowledge once you found out what was going on?
Well, in part there was some peace in that it was like, okay, so we haven't been crazy for all this time, that there had been something going on and we just didn't know what it was. But granted, in some ways it was more like peace after he had passed away, because we didn't even have time to really process what it meant or what the symptoms were. Like we had to look it up after the fact, what people with pancreatic cancer usually go through, because we only had that 2 week period between diagnosis and passing. Yeah, like I can't say at the time, just hearing it was just such a shock. And you know, not knowing exactly how much time he had left, because the doctors, of course, it's really hard to gauge that usually. So the 2 week period was definitely like faster than expected, but it was just so late term at that point. And that was why it was so fast.
Right. Well, I want to kind of get back to some of the things that you had to deal with and manage. around that time. But I also first want to talk to you about your experience becoming an adult without your dad around. You've talked previously about this idea of lost knowledge transfer that comes with losing a parent when you're still a kid. So I'm wondering, you know, what maybe some of those moments in your life were, those milestones over these years where that's really become noticeable to you?
I think anytime I kind of like see my friends be able to have conversations with their fathers when they're adults, which like, I guess I feel some envy, but I don't feel like it's not jealousy. I'm happy for them that they have their fathers. But at the same time, like, you know, like there were, I lost him before I even got to graduate from high school. So I didn't get to consult with him when it came to like choosing a college. Like I had to do that with, I mean, my mother was there and thank God for that. My dad was the person that had been in the working world for a while at that point with front of my two parents, because my mom was a full-time stay-at-home mom. So my dad was kind of like the one that we would turn to when it came to things like, I don't know, like career advice, you know, or, you know, education advice, of course, because he was at a university. So obviously he had all this insider knowledge about how do universities work, what I should look for when it comes to choosing a college or a university, and just like choosing a major, you know, like every single step, there were so many conversations I was so wished I could have had with him that I never was able to. And then like once I, you know, after a major, after I've graduated from college and from high school, like what do I do then? What kind of career should I look at? How do I even find a career? You know, what kind of jobs should I look at? And so all of that stuff, like my mom was very supportive and was like emotionally very there for me, but she had no, her last job had been when they were both in graduate school, when she was working and he was getting his PhD in economics. That was kind of the last time she was paid for a position. So at that point, it had been decades. My parents had us, my mom was 42 when she had me. So they were not elderly parents, but they were older. So she had been out of the job market for a long time at that point. And then being able to talk to someone about balancing how to choose a job, how to choose where I should live, how to choose a partner. And my mom was probably better at that, at like the romantic start stuff than my dad probably would have been. And I feel bad for my brother on that account, because I feel like it is easier for a son to talk to his father when it comes to, you know, things like that, when it comes to like, at least if you're maybe, I don't know if it's different, but if you're a heterosexual male, it's easier to talk to a fellow heterosexual male if you're looking for a female spouse. I think my brother really missed out on that. And I feel like my relationship with men was also kind of stunted, because it took me a long time to date. Actually, I didn't really date in college. And I think in part because like, I was still mourning. I was still kind of like just processing, and I didn't really know like who I could trust in terms of like finding a partner. And I think I was a bit like delayed. I was a bit of a late bloomer. And I don't think I would have been so cautious about it if I had had more time with my dad to kind of talk through some of those things and just, you know, develop fully in certain ways. Yeah. And then it's strange that I end up doing something in the end. When I went to my master's degree, I did end up taking international economics, which was, it's not a PhD in economics, of course. I can certainly never claim to have the same level of knowledge as my dad had on the nitty gritty. And he was a fantastic mathematician as well. And I am not a fantastic mathematician. So we definitely still had our differences on that stuff. But I would have just loved to talk to him now that I know what economics really is. When he died, I didn't know that much about it. But now that I've kind of immersed myself more in macroeconomic policy and to an extent theory. I just would love to have those conversations with him to like better understand these things in the economy and then be able to understand him better as a result. But those are also things that, you know, we lost. And just like other practical things, saving money, you know, bank accounts, taxes, like all that stuff. That's all stuff that we just never got to cover when I was 16.
Yeah, it's really interesting learning about your dad, having known you in the professional working world these past few years, because, you know, you've accomplished so much, and hearing about kind of the challenges that you faced and making those decisions, and then the legacy that he has, that's really pretty cool. Yeah, I'm sure it'd be remarkable, the kinds of conversations that the two of you would have today. We've already kind of started getting into this, but you had used the words retooling the family when we spoke about this earlier, in terms of how your family adapted to the absence of your dad. And I wondered if there are other family members, or just, I don't know, maybe even just the way that your nuclear family kind of changed and the way it operated, that you wanted to share.
I think one of the things that every family probably goes through when they lose someone is kind of figuring out like how to fulfill some of the roles that person had that leaves like this giant cavern when they pass. I always thought about it kind of like we shifted from being like a four-wheel drive car to being like a tricycle, you know, where we only had three wheels all of a sudden. It used to be my dad, my mom, my brother, and myself. And then when we lost my dad, it was like we lost one of the front wheels. And so we had to then shift into this tripod vehicle where we all kind of tried to pick up the slack a little bit. I think that one of the primary things that shifted between my mom and myself is that she and my dad were incredibly close and always coordinated on almost everything. You know, they were a very tight-knit couple. They were a very tight-knit team. And when dad passed away, I saw my mom's shift a lot, of course. I mean, it was a huge blow to her. She lost a little bit of her confidence. I would say like her personality changed a bit, where she just sounded a lot less certain about the world and everything. And so what ended up happening more is that she would rely on me for talking, someone else to talk to that she could trust to kind of make some of these decisions, or like just talking about like the slings and arrows of the day in a way that like she never would have talked to me about before, because before I was always the kid. So she was just she would protect me maybe from, you know, problems that were going on. And now, you know, she didn't have any, she had her siblings, but they were all, you know, scattered throughout the United States. Nobody was in San Diego with us, even though they were like very, they would call in and everybody in the family tried to check in, but it's different being there on a daily basis. So I think that was one of the things that shifted. And also just, we were really, really fortunate in that my dad was the primary and only breadwinner, but because he was an economist, he had made it so that mom wouldn't have to start working, and I wouldn't, you know, like I could complete my education and I wouldn't have to start working after he passed away, even though he wasn't cognizant that he was going to pass away so soon when he was only 59. Thankfully, my brother was also living at home at the time when dad passed as well, even though he was in college. So he was able to kind of take on more of some of the male roles, I guess. It was more like physical grunt labor. My brother didn't necessarily become like the parent. It was just more that we were all working as a team on things. If there was a problem with the house, it was much more likely that we would work on it as a team, and it wouldn't just be like my mom or my dad like trying to figure out what to do with it. We would, you know, talk about something being broken together and if we needed to call a repairman or if we should try to do it ourselves, you know, that kind of thing. And then we had family friends that certainly came in to help as well. There was one thing that happens is that, and I remember Luke on one of your, one of your previous podcasts talked about this, where like there's initially there's like, when someone dies, there's this flood of people that are there to like help in the initial after effects of it. And they, you know, they want to like give their, you know, donate food and like make you dinner and, you know, drop off casseroles. And we ate so many like chicken casseroles and chicken dishes that my mom ended up never being able to make chicken for like a really long time after that. She didn't make a roast. I don't think to this day, she's now, I mean, I guess things have changed. She now only gets chicken when it's pre-made at like Costco, you know, those like little
rotisserie
chickens. Yeah. So, but she used to make a rotisserie chicken like twice a week. And then all of a sudden my dad passes away. We have chicken for like a year. And my mom decides that she can just never make chicken again. But like after that, they eventually go away and you have to kind of figure it out on your own. But some of my dad's colleagues did step in, like my dad, our really close family friend, Ross, he took his duties really seriously. I think my dad had talked to him before he had passed and said, please look after my family, you know, and like, please make sure that they know what they're doing and that they're okay. And like, you know, serve if you can as like a kind of financial advisor, because, you know, my mom, they had a very traditional marriage. Like my mom took care of the house and the cleaning and the kids, and my dad was the breadwinner and then took care of the finances and the taxes and all that stuff. And when dad passed, my mom was kind of like left to try to figure all this stuff out. And our friend Ross, who was also a professor at UCSD, also an economist, really took it seriously and made sure my mom was okay, helped her kind of find an accountant, you know, helped her find advisors, and served as an advisor as well, so that she could manage all of these like financial things. And that was important to our survival, you know, is to just understanding and knowing those things, because it was just completely out of her depth at that point. Sorry, that was a lot of ranting, but
No, I appreciate you sharing. And it's, it's just interesting hearing about the transition from, you know, a lot of that decision-making happening, you know, either between your parents or things that just your dad handled, and how you kind of moved to more of this collective problem-solving approach in your family. And this also kind of gets to something else I wanted to ask you about, which is more of the, you know, logistical aspects of your father's death and what your family's experience was making arrangements for your dad. And then maybe also within that question is how has that experience influenced the way that you think about your own death and how to plan for it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think my dad, his father passed away relatively suddenly in the 80s, where they were not expecting it. And because of that, even though his father was an economist, his father didn't really think about his death quite as much. And because of that, there was like not a lot of preparation. And I think my grandfather, I can't remember if he had a will, but they ended up, you know, going through a kind of messy process when he passed away. And there was probate, you know, where there was a lot of the estate, you know, ended up, you know, being subsumed by taxes, which, you know, I'm all for, you know, an estate tax and everything, but like, it was just something that they hadn't prepared for and they didn't know it was going to happen. And so my dad, I think after that, then decided we have to have our ducks together in a row, just in case something happens to me, to him, that is. So he ended up starting a family trust in the 90s, he started a family trust to just in case something happened to him, we wouldn't lose the house. The house would be put in the family trust and we wouldn't have to sell the house in case he died. And then like, you know, my mom again doesn't work. So we would be like really high and dry without a paddle if he passed away. So he ended up putting a lot of the assets in this family trust, but it turns out that he set up the family trust, but then he hadn't put anything in until he found out that this was a fatal cancer. And then there was this scramble right before he died, like literally deathbed He's signing documents on his deathbed to make sure that everything that was meant to be in there, you know, like if it was like his, the property, like our house, when it came to like his stock portfolio that he had managed, again, economist. So he was, you know, he had like managed some stocks on the sides, all of that stuff, trying to put it into the family trust just to make sure that we're okay. Because if he had passed without putting it, any of that stuff in there, we would have had to, you know, sell like 40% of whatever it was, just because that's what happens. We're not like a wealthy family. It was just that we were well enough off that we were fortunate that we could have things like stocks and obviously like to have a house even. And the house at that point they had bought in the 70s. This is like the San Diego real estate market. So they have a house like where we have like we're on a hill and we have an ocean view. So like the property value of the house had gone up a lot since they had bought it, you know, at that point, more than like 25 years ago or something at that point. And so if he had died and then there all of a sudden we had to pay massive taxes on the house, we definitely would have had to sell it because we could not have paid for that on our own. So it was like those types of things that we were just so fortunate that I strongly recommend people look into if they ever have, you know, when they're trying to think of how do they help their loved ones. You definitely want to have a will if you're the type of family that you think requires it. Granted, it's not like, I think honestly that a lot more people should consider living trusts than they realize. And it's just like, you don't have to be some sort of like multi-billionaire family to consider a living trust. It's something that I think everybody should consider, just because like, especially if you're like if one family member is making most of the money, if you don't have a living trust, something happens to you, your kids are still very young, like that will completely transform their lives. And then also just having like a life insurance as well, which my dad had tried to maintain multiple life insurance policies. Unfortunately, when he got older and sicker, he stopped maintaining, I think, some of the major ones, but he still had, I don't know why he had so many life insurance policies out on himself, but he had several. And my mom said that we still got some of them, which managed to help pay for some of the costs and fees when he passed, but it didn't necessarily, it sounds like, help pay for after that. Like it didn't necessarily contribute income as much when he passed. But the death certificates are also something that we didn't realize how many we would need. Sometimes to this day, you know, 20 years later, I think we had ordered over 50 death certificates and we ended up using every single one of those. And having often when like you're trying to close down accounts, even if it's something that's as like minute as a gym membership, you know, my dad had a gym membership to LA Fitness that he didn't end up using for years. So my mom didn't even realize he had this gym membership. But then she saw there was these automatic withdrawals coming out of their bank account and it was the gym membership. And she had to try to tell them like, listen, he passed away. Like, A, is there any way to like get the money back that like when he passed away, obviously, you know, he wasn't in those months, he wasn't going to the gym because he was deceased. And B, like, how do we, can we cancel the gym membership? And they said that they could only cancel it if they had a death certificate, and it had to be an original death certificate for a gym membership. And that's like, that happened repeatedly, you know, when it came to just like transferring things into my mom's name, we had to like always produce a death certificate, like every single little, whatever it may be, credit card, everything requires a death certificate. And you just have no understanding that you'll need so many. And if you wait, if you don't get them immediately, at least this is true in California, it ends up being way more expensive later on. If you try to order subsequent death certificates, it makes way more sense to just get as many as you can at the time of passing. So that was also something that I just practically, I just recommend if you know someone, that if someone in your family dies, get way more death certificates than you ever thought that you would need.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you talk about all this because, you know, even someone like me who thinks quite a bit about death and those kinds of arrangements, I don't have a will and I'm not sure that anyone in my family does. And it's something that I definitely want to talk to them about. But I think for so long, it's kind of felt like, you know, living trusts are something for the wealthy elite.
Right.
When the reality is that these things can make a huge difference for people, even if, you know, you're of modest wealth.
Yeah. And I guess that's one thing that I just wanted. It does sound like even just mentioning if you, it's like, oh, my family has a trust. It's like, oh, you're a trust fund baby. But no, like people, I think from all backgrounds, this is something that the wealthy have known about obviously for decades and decades, and they've used it. Mm-hmm. But like, my point is, this is something that everybody, if it's there, you know, people should, of all kind of backgrounds, should consider using that to help and to support their families should they go before they realize that they, you know, when they're not just like in their dotage. It was a huge game changer for us. If that hadn't happened, I would have had to switch schools. I probably would have had to get, you know, not that that would be the worst thing in the world, but I probably would have had to, you know, work on the weekends and after school. Like my life would have shifted completely in a way when I was already just struggling for air and my family was struggling for air. I couldn't imagine having to then compound that with like trying to support ourselves completely independently financially and having to like sell the house and stuff like that if in the middle of grieving for your loved one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to wrap up and ask you one last question and then give you a little bit of time to say anything else you'd like to say in honor of your dad. But the last thing I wanted to ask about is your memories with your dad. And you said that memory is your largest enemy and your greatest asset when it comes to grieving. So how do you remember your dad, and what are those moments in your life where you can have some sort of communion with him or his spirit?
I found that I think a big part of the grieving process is just in some ways forgetting who that person is in order you'll never forget that person, but like small memories of them, like remembering, I don't know, that you would see that person every day, like your body seeing that person every day, like kind of forgetting that you're going to see them and forgetting, it becomes less, I think the body, it becomes less painful when you start forgetting smaller things about them. Like I now have to struggle to remember what his voice sounded like and certain mannerisms. Like sometimes I'll see a stranger on the street do something and I'll be like, I forgot my dad used to do that. And it's, you feel guilty when you forget some of those things, but at the same time, I think it's the only way that your brain can kind of like move on and function. If you were stuck with all of that memory, it would be too painful to keep going and to like move on with your life. If you were stuck with every single little detail about that person. But how I usually remember him now is that I physically resemble my father a fair amount in certain ways. Like I'm also relatively tall, not like terribly tall, I'm 5'10". But how my body is composed, it's very similar to him. My hands are basically his, but the female version. My feet are very much his, but I guess slightly smaller. But I have what are called hammer toes. My brother has them too. So my father had them where our feet stick up at a 90, our toes will stick up at like a 90 degree angle, like they're in a defensive posture when we walk. It's kind of it's a very distinctive trait that I always look down at them and I'm always Like, I always think of my dad when I see them, you know, and I, or if I see my nose, I think of my dad when I see him. And my voice, to a certain extent, the cadence of my voice is very similar to my father and my grandfather, it turns out, which I hadn't realized until years later. And I don't know, like, I sometimes it's just, I feel like the memories that I hang on to the most about him are remembering how happy he was outside in the outdoors. He loves skiing. We didn't get to do it a lot because, of course, we're in San Diego, so we'd only take one big ski trip a year. But I just have such fond memories of him on the slopes and him hiking. And often when I go home to San Diego, my mom is still in the same house that we grew up in and where my dad was. And I will look at the stairs between the first story and the second story. And he would always, in the morning, it was his thing to kind of sit on the stairs, read the newspaper, have his glasses propped up on his forehead. And he was very, very nearsighted. So he'd bring the newspaper right up to his nose. So there was practically no separation between the paper and his face. And he would just be peering down on it and be like moving his head like a, you know, like a typewriter, where he's just trying to like read it when he was so myopic, he could, you know, like barely see anything. But then he would just cackle when he would read something funny he would, you know, read an article and he'd just be cackling on the stairs, drinking his coffee, reading the New York Times and, you know, having the time of his life in the morning. So I feel like that's one of the memories that I always cherish. But yeah, there's like thousands of little things every day that where you just remember that person because something you do or something someone else says reminds you of them.
Well, that's really sweet, Marika. And it's, I feel like I know you better just learning about this person that means so much to you and being able to kind of have an image of who he was. And just that last scene of him with the newspaper, I think is a really good one. So I just want to thank you again for sharing your perspective on this. I think it's something we don't hear enough about, how loss affects us over time. I want to just give you the last, you know, couple of minutes here to see if there's anything else you'd like to share or say about your dad.
One thing that I wanted to say is that I think if you lose someone before they were ready for it and before you were ready for it, a lot of stuff gets left unsaid. And so you end up having to kind of like over years trying to process that and also forgive yourself for everything that, you know, you weren't able to say to them or they weren't able to say to you. You know, I think that's something that you just have to like give yourself room for grace in that process, because it's definitely like a long term, like a long haul thing. And I feel like I'm certainly a lot better now than when my dad initially passed away. And I just felt like there was like so much left unsaid and regrets. And he passed away with a lot of regrets, I know. But you just have to cherish the time that you did have with that person and that you did get to know that person, you know. And I just remember every day, like people who don't, you know, like they lose sometimes their parents when they're like an infant, you know, they never had a chance to get to know their parent. And like how you just have to grasp onto whatever you do have and the moments that you were able to know that person and they were about to be a part of your life. And through that, you know, you are that vessel where they will always be able to keep living. I'm not a religious person, but I do feel like I do believe in the idea that we are the living memorials of the people that we knew and that we lost, especially if you're a child of someone that passed away. But I think that's true for pretty much anyone, because we all end up having an impact on each other and influencing each other. And becoming a tapestry of the people that we know.
That's so beautiful, the idea of a living memorial and thinking about people as vessels. I love that. Thank you so much, Marika.